We live in an era of absolutely unprecedented technological and economic growth. I mean, by almost every metric, human history is at a peak right now.
Right, it's a massive peak.
Yeah, and yet if you think about the future, it almost invariably feels like a looming disaster, doesn't
Why
it?
totally? It's like this constant shadow.
Exactly. So why are we so stubbornly stuck in a business as usual mindset when, all the warning lights on the global dashboard are just flashing red?
It's the defining contradiction of our time, really.
It is. And today, under the banner of Futures Research Unpacked, we're jumping right into that conceptual paradox for this deep dive.
Yeah, because we have more data, more predictive models, and just way more technological capability than any generation before us.
Right.
But we seem collectively paralyzed when it comes to steering away from these obvious cliffs. So our source material today is this deeply reflective paper by Richard A. Slaughter. It's titled Future Studies as a Quest for Meaning.
And the mission of this deep dive is to explore Slaughter's 40-year career as a foresight practitioner. We really want to understand the mechanics of, well, why humanity has so consistently ignored these early wake-up calls.
Yeah, that's the core question here.
And crucially, how we can radically shift our perception to avoid a dystopian outcome.
Right. And to frame this, we are unpacking a highly conceptual paper today. We're looking at Slaughter's theoretical critique of the whole grand narrative of
The
progress.
idea that things are always just getting better.
Exactly. But his most significant contribution, the real core of this framework, is the idea that fixing our massive exterior global crises actually requires cultivating a very profound interior capability.
Which he calls depth perception.
Yes, depth
Wow, I love
perceptus.
that term. But before we get to the solution, we have to kind of look at the historical context of how we lost our way.
We do. We have to understand the baseline.
Right, so Slaughter takes us back to 1945, which is the year he was born. And he calls this year zero of the Anthropocene the human era.
It's a great starting point for this debate.
It really is.
Yeah.
And the contrast he paints between then and now, it isn't just about time. It's about the sheer scale of human impact. Back then, the global population was just over 2 billion.
Which sounds tiny now.
I know, right? Today, for you and me, it's over 7 billion.
And he describes growing up in post-war Britain to really illustrate that baseline we started from. His grandmother's house was literally still lit by gas.
Wow, gaslighting.
Yeah, and telephones were these heavy bakelite blocks with twisted cords. His father walked to work.
So it was a world that moved at a pace dictated by physical human limitations.
Exactly. But then the myth of progress really took hold, and the numbers from that era are just staggering. I mean, between 1950 and 1970, global industrial production tripled.
Tripled in just 20 years.
In just two decades, humanity extracted and manufactured three times as much material as it ever had before.
That's insane. And that created this incredible illusion of total mastery over the natural world.
It did. But Slaughter points out that this unprecedented growth actually created a deeply abnormal and, frankly, completely unsustainable world.
Right. But we didn't see it that way at the time.
No, because the immediate results were higher living standards and all these technological marvels. So the long-term unsustainability was completely masked. The success of the present basically hid the failure of the future.
And that brings up this foundational debate in future studies. The establishment totally believe in this unstoppable arrow of human progress.
They are fully bought in.
But then in the late 1960s and 70s, the physical reality of a finite planet began to push back. We actually had early mathematically sound warnings.
Right, like Rachel Carson's book.
Yes, Silent Spring in 1962. It tracked the bioaccumulation of pesticides, warning of ecological collapse, and then came the famous Limits to Growth report in 1972.
Which used early computer models.
Exactly. It demonstrated that infinite economic growth on a finite planet was mathematically impossible.
But the reaction to those warnings is really the crux of the issue here. The establishment just vehemently rejected them.
They hated it.
Oh, the warnings were treated as heresy because they contradicted that core doctrine of continuous economic expansion.
So the human species was being asked to wake up to the global consequences of its own success, and the establishment basically collectively decided to reject the data to protect the economic model.
That's exactly it. They protected the model over reality.
Okay, let's unpack this. It feels like humanity boarded a high-speed luxury train in 1950. The champagne is flowing, the speed is thrilling, and the engineering feels
I
flawless.
like this analogy.
Right. Then, in the 1970s, the engineers come back to the passenger cars and say, "Hey, excuse me, we've looked at the route and the tracks ahead are actually missing.
The bridge is out.
Exactly. And instead of hitting the brakes, the passengers just vote to close the blinds and turn up the music.
That is exactly what happened, because the drivers of the impending disaster weren't even hidden. They were right outside the window.
Right there in plain sight.
Yeah. And this cultural denial is reflected so brilliantly in our art and literature from that period onward.
Oh, the sci-fi stuff.
Yeah. Slaughter references the leading British science fiction author, Brian Aldiss, who summarized the entire sci-fi genre in just four words. Hubris clobbered by nemesis.
Hubris clobbered by nemesis. Man, that captures the entire dynamic so perfectly.
It really does.
We act with extreme arrogance, we ignore natural limits, and the inevitable consequence, the nemesis just comes to collect.
And dystopian visions became a staple of our culture precisely because our subconscious recognized what our conscious minds refused to accept.
We knew the crash was coming.
Exactly. We were watching the train speed toward the missing tracks, and while our conscious economic policies just ignored it, our art and storytelling became completely obsessed with the inevitable crash.
So if willfully closing the blinds on this train is our default, what's driving that psychological block? This is where the conversation in Slaughter's paper shifts to his theoretical framework for understanding why we ignore the future, and more importantly, how we can actually anchor ourselves.
Right. And he introduces this concept he calls the dialectic of foresight and experience.
Foresight and experience.
Yeah. So foresight is our cognitive ability to think ahead, plan, and evaluate future consequences. Experience, on the other hand, is our immediate visceral reaction to the world around us right now.
And currently, human experience is just dominating our decision making.
Completely dominating
it. Meaning, like, evolutionarily, we are wired to react only to the tiger jumping out of the bushes today, not the slow depletion of the tiger's habitat over a century.
Right. We only react when the crisis is actively flooding our living room.
We are such a deeply reactive species.
We are. And Slaughter notes that Machiavelli pointed out this exact human flaw centuries ago. He said that men are so focused on present necessities, they rarely look ahead to future dangers.
So we severely underutilize foresight, because our biological and economic systems heavily reward immediate experience.
Exactly. And Slaughter directs a pretty sharp structural critique here regarding why this imbalance persists.
Just to be clear, we're neutrally reporting his arguments here.
Of course. His argument is that market-led ideologies and corporate interests actively prioritize short-term wealth over long-term survival.
Right.
He points specifically to commentators who focus solely on continuous prosperity metrics while actively ignoring planetary limits. So the argument is that consumerism structurally demands the liquidation of the Earth's natural capital just to sustain its own growth.
It's a systemic loop. Mm-hmm. A blind market-led ideology creates short-term incentives that actively block long-term survival strategy.
Yeah, because if a CEO's bonus is tied to quarterly profits, the biological bias toward immediate experience is institutionalized. Foresight literally becomes an economic liability.
But I have to admit, I struggle a bit with focusing on this interior psychological flaw as the primary battlefield. Well, my instinct is that if the physical climate is collapsing, if the external world is literally breaking nurse fee, we need external physical technology to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, better AI, massive carbon capture networks, nuclear fusion.
Sure, the tech will save us approach.
Right. Does Slaughter really think self-reflection outpaces technology when the planet is actively warming?
He directly addresses that reliance on a technological savior, and his answer is a very firm no.
Really?
Yeah. In his view, technology is only marginally helpful, and it often distracts from the root cause. He argues the digital revolution has been drastically oversold.
Oversold? In what way?
Well, instead of providing ecological salvation, it has introduced massive new systemic risks.
Ah, and he brings up Shoshana Zuboff's work on surveillance capitalism here, right?
He does, yes. He uses it to illustrate how technology gets co-opted by the exact same short-term market-led ideologies.
Because surveillance capitalism is the mechanism where our digital lives and personal experiences are harvested as behavioral data.
Exactly. And that data is then used to manipulate our behavior for corporate profit. So the technology isn't being deployed to build long-term foresight.
It's being deployed to hyper-stimulate our immediate experience and drive even more consumerism.
Which just reinforces the exact dialectic imbalance that is causing the ecological crisis in the first place.
Okay, so technology isn't the life raft. If the external world is a runaway train, and tech is just building a better entertainment system inside the passenger cars, where do we turn?
That is the big question. And Slaughter points to the philosopher Ken Wilber's four quadrants as a reliable framework to navigate this.
The four quadrants. Let's break that down.
Sure. Wilber's integral framework maps how we can view reality through four distinct lenses or windows. First, you have the exterior collective.
That's our observable global systems, like our physical ecologies, the economy.
Right. Second is the exterior individual. That's our observable physical behaviors.
Okay.
Third is the interior collective, so our shared culture, social norms, and language.
And then the fourth window.
The fourth window is the interior individual. This is our personal psychology, our self-knowledge, our inner world of meaning.
I understand the map, but what is the mechanism here? Like, how does looking inward at my own interior individual quadrant, maybe by reading a sociology book, actually stop a climate disaster happening in the exterior collective quadrant?
What's fascinating here is the causal chain Slaughter maps out between those specific quadrants.
Tell me more.
Without deep self-knowledge, human beings operate almost entirely from a place of ego and short-term appetites. Driven by that ego, our interior individual values prioritize immediate gratification.
Which makes sense.
And that drives our exterior individual behaviors, what we buy, how we vote. Those behaviors aggregate to shape our interior collective culture, normalizing hyperconsumerism.
Wow.
And then that culture ultimately builds the exterior collective economic systems that are currently liquidating the biosphere.
So it's the ultimate cascade effect. The global crisis is really just a macro expression of the unexamined human ego.
That's a perfect way to put it. When you do the personal work in that interior quadrant, when you actually quiet the relentless demands of the ego, you realize that you are not the center of the universe.
You realize you're just a single thread in a vast ancient tapestry.
Exactly. And that realization generates profound modesty. Yeah. It is only from that place of modesty, stripped of ego, that we actually have the capacity to do collective long-term futures work.
So self-knowledge is literally the prerequisite for genuine foresight.
Yes. If you are trapped in your ego, you literally cannot perceive consequences beyond your own lifespan.
That completely shifts the entire paradigm. It flips the script from we need to invent a better solar panel to we need to fundamentally restructure how our minds interact with reality.
It does.
Which brings us to the application of this concept, how this internal shift creates what Slaughter calls depth perception and how it literally changes our relationship with the external world.
Right, because depth perception, in this context, is the act of removing the habitual filters covering our eyes. It is learning to see the intricate underlying systems of the world rather than just looking at their surface utility.
He gives some really fascinating micro examples of this, starting with his time living in Bermuda as a young teacher.
Oh, the Bermuda example is great.
Yeah, he watched primeval Bermuda, which was this incredibly complex ancient natural system, just get bulldozed by 20th century development.
Right.
And it made him realize how human beings who lack depth perception view nature merely as a convenient platform. Like it's just a blank stage for us to pour concrete on. We don't see the ecosystem. We just see real estate.
We completely fail to perceive the interconnected web of life because our unexamined ego only values what is immediately useful to us.
Yes.
But Slaughter extends this concept of depth perception far beyond ecology. He applies it to how we interact with human culture, too, like art.
Yes. He brings up Peter Bruegel the Elder's 1569 painting, Netherlandish Proverbs.
Have you seen it?
I have. And if you look at this painting without depth perception, it honestly just looks like a chaotic, almost nightmarish village landscape. There are dozens of weird figures doing completely nonsensical things.
But if you engage your depth perception, he calls it a symbolic palimpsest.
A palimpsest being like an ancient manuscript where the original text was scraped off so someone could write over it, but the old ghost letters still bleed through to the surface.
Precisely. The surface image is just a village, but the deeper layer reveals over 100 human follies and proverbs depicted in a single image. You have to actively read the depth.
He points out a man literally casting roses before a pig. It's a visual representation of wasted effort.
And there are so many details like that.
Yeah, and my absolute favorite detail in the background of a mundane plowing scene, if you look incredibly closely at the sea, you can just barely spot the tiny, unnoticed legs of Icarus falling into the water.
Oh, wow.
Right. The mythological tragedy of flying too close to the sun is happening right there, and the entire village is just carrying on, completely ignoring it.
It is a staggering metaphor for our current global crisis. The ultimate tragedy of hubris is happening, but everyone is too busy plowing their fields and tending to their immediate economic needs to even notice.
So true.
The pigment on the canvas is just the surface. The depth of meaning requires the viewer to actively engage. And Slaughter applies this exact same mechanism to music.
He talks about the composer Chopin and also the origins of jazz.
Right, because if you just casually listen to jazz while you're, like, answering emails, it's superficial. It's just background noise.
But deep immersion reveals the soul of the musicians, the oppressive social conditions they were surviving, and the cultural resistance embedded in the notes.
And to explain how this works, Slaughter introduces a concept from the economist E.F. Schumacher called adequateo.
Adequateo.
Yeah. It's the principle that the receiver of information must be adequately tuned to understand what is being conveyed.
Think of it like a radio receiver.
Exactly. The profound depth of a jazz riff or the complex ecology of a forest is constantly broadcasting. But if your internal dial is set only to immediate gratification, you just hear static.
So cultivating depth perception is basically the act of upgrading your internal receiver.
That's exactly what it is.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because he brings this idea of adequateo right back to the natural world. How do we tune our receiver to nature?
Well, he mentions an essay by Rick Bass about the larch tree.
And Bass isn't just romanticizing a piece of wood. Through deep observation, he understands how this specific species evolved to respond to wind and fire, and how it hosts a massive ecosystem even in its decay.
Right. And then there's James Butler's research on the superb blue fairy wrens in Australia.
Oh, these are tiny, common birds. To the untrained eye or a mind lacking adequate acuity, they are just generic birds chirping in a bush.
But researchers analyze their songs, and they aren't just random chirps.
No, they're incredibly complex, downward cascading musical notes that serve highly specific, intricate social functions within their flocks.
And the kicker is, this species has been performing this complex communication for a million years.
A million years of unbroken evolutionary brilliance just happening in the background of our daily commutes.
It's wild. When we lack depth perception, we look at the wren and just see an object. When we cultivate depth perception, we tune our receiver to witness a million-year-old lineage.
We start to comprehend the sheer scale and complexity of the non-human world. It makes me think about how we navigate our daily routines, you know.
How so?
Imagine you are walking through an ancient, old-growth forest, but you are staring down at a spreadsheet on your phone, stressing about quarterly earnings.
That is the ultimate lack of depth perception.
Gaining it means putting the phone away, looking up, and realizing that the forest you're standing in isn't just timber. It is a billion-piece, interconnected supercomputer that actually breathes. It completely shifts your reality.
And this brings us to the vital connective tissue of Slaughter's argument. How does appreciating the song of a blue fairy wren or the complexity of a larch tree actually stop an oil spill or halt a runaway economic model?
How does the micro change the macro?
Well, when a critical mass of society develops this depth perception, they stop seeing the Earth as a convenient platform to extract from. A shift in the interior individual quadrant changes everything else.
It cascades outward.
Exactly. If you truly comprehend the million-year complexity of an ecosystem, your consumer demands change. Your voting behaviors change. The threshold for what a society will allow corporations to destroy fundamentally shifts.
Because you cannot ruthlessly exploit a system once you possess the adequate acuity to understand its profound depth.
You just can't.
And that answers the ultimate question posed at the conclusion of this paper. What is the true purpose of future studies?
Right, because it is not, as many corporate strategists assume, to help the economic growth machine predict the next market trend so they can sell more stuff in the next quarter.
The true purpose is to move humanity beyond the paralyzing fear of dystopia. We established early on that we are haunted by the nemesis of our hubris. But dystopia shouldn't be a source of despair. It must be utilized as a powerful motivator.
And Slaughter references the environmental activist Joanna Macy here, specifically her work on how we process the threat of ecological or nuclear collapse.
Her work is all about moving from despair to active empowerment.
Yeah. You face the darkness, you accept the stark reality of the missing tracks ahead of the train, but you don't let it crush you into apathy.
You use that stark reality to build a civilizationally coherent vision, a vision that prioritizes cultural healing and ecological restoration over blind resource extraction.
Exactly.
So, what does this all mean for you listening to this deep dive? It means that accepting business as usual is a highly dangerous illusion.
It really is.
It means that the internal work of reinvigorating our connection to reality, actually seeing the large tree, truly hearing the jazz music, understanding the staggering complexity of the systems operating around us, isn't just tree-hugger romanticism.
No, it is a vital, necessary survival skill. We are navigating a deeply abnormal era in human history. To survive it, we have to transcend our shallow, utilitarian view of the world.
So true.
Slaughter quotes the author Hermann Hesse from his novel Siddhartha to perfectly encapsulate this philosophy. Hesse wrote, "Meaning and reality are not hidden somewhere behind things. They are in them, in all of them."
They are in them. The depth is already there, just waiting for us to tune our receivers.
You just have to listen.
If the depth of the universe is hiding in plain sight, in a bird song, a jazz riff, or the trees outside your window, what everyday object or system in your own life are you looking at right now without truly seeing? And how might unlocking its depth completely change the way you navigate your own future?